You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of April 3rd, 2024, and I think video games are just peachy.
I'm George Shawboy.
My name is Scott Chester.
And this is a serious but humorous conversation about video games. We're going to check in a little bit on some games that we've been playing this week. Yep. We got some card games. We got some bugs. We got some peaches. what else we got? Dogs and suits? Who knows?
Oh my God. Just wait for that one.
So we're going to talk a little bit about some games we've been playing. Do you want me to start?
Yes. Why don't I start? Take us in, yeah.
Okay, so I've been meaning to talk to you about this on the podcast for a while. This game, Bellatro, took the internet by storm. I think now it's the third highest rated game of 2024 so far. I have a hard time imagining this will be knocked out of the top 10 in terms of positive ratings.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it just seems to be going like more and more. It's stuck around, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I'm gonna make a bold claim here. I think that if you play Bellatro, there's a good chance that this is in your top three games of the year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the only reason why I haven't played it so far is because I'm kind of scared to play it, because what will happen to me?
It is very good. Yeah. Okay, so if you're listening and you're not aware of what Bellatro is, it's basically poker on steroids. this is a game that I think is so impressive in the way that it takes poker, which many of us know and love, and adds layer upon layer upon layer of complexity. And yet it is an extremely elegant execution of all of those ideas, right?
Yep.
So just for some context, you start off the game with a normal deck of 52 cards, and your goal is to produce the best hand out of 8 cards that are dealt to you in order to earn a minimum amount of chips in a set of 4 rounds, right? Mm-hmm. In the beginning, or 4 hands. So you'll get 8 cards. You'll pick the best hand that you can, play that hand, get some chips, draw back up to 8 cards, rinse, rots, wash, repeat until you either hit that goal or come under that goal. That's the basic idea. Yep. The ante, which is the cost, the amount of chips that you're trying to earn, goes up aggressively as you play. And so the only way to keep up with that is by augmenting the elements of your deck itself and the rules of the game. One of the ways you augment them are by just buying new cards. You can add new cards to the deck. So you can have 5 aces and you have 5 of a kind now, right? Or maybe you're buying a lot of clubs and now it's a lot easier to build a flush, right? You can also augment the cards themselves with a variety of sort of packs that you buy in between rounds in a sort of roguelite manner. Mm-hmm. These could be things like making a card wild so it counts as any suit. It could be a card that when it's scored, it multiplies the score of your entire score. They could be cards that say, if this stays in your hand, you'll get more money at the end of the round. There's a bunch of different ways that you can sort of change the individual cards, right? You can also find what are called celestial packs, which change the value of hands. So when you start, a 3 of a kind might be worth, I don't remember it off the top of my head, something like 50 chips, base chips, plus a 4 times multiplier, right? And every card is worth points, I should say, as well. So all of that kind of adds up, right? That will be your base value of a 3 of a kind. If, however, you upgraded 3 of a kind to, say, plus 5, suddenly you're scoring, you know, 120 chips multiplied by 10 every time you score 3 of a kind. You could easily get to a place where your 3 of a kind scores you more points than a straight flush, right? It is by far the best hand you could play, which puts you in scenarios where you want to play a 3 of a kind instead of a full house, right? Bizarre scenarios that don't exist in actual poker. And then on top of that, there are vouchers that will change rules consistently throughout your entire run, like giving you plus 1 hand size. So now you get to make an extra hand whenever you're making these runs. Or giving you extra discards, which are a way to allow you to discard the cards you don't want and hopefully draw the cards that you do. And then on top of that, there's all of the Jokers. And the Jokers is where the money's at, right? These are like the weird cards that sort of add random multipliers, or they tweak how many points you get in certain scenarios, or they change how much money you get between rounds. So just to give you this last run that I was on, that was like a God tier hand, right? I had a Joker that said I could make straights with only four cards instead of five. Mm. Great, right? I had another Joker that said I could make straights with skipped numbers. So I could play like ace, queen, 10, 8, 7.
Oh, so you could like, so yeah, so it doesn't have to be sequential, but as long as they go in order from small to big, it doesn't have to be in full sequential order.
Correct. Yeah. Yep. I had another Joker that said whenever I played a straight, I just got a bunch more fucking chips, right? And then I got a card that said every time I play a straight, I increase the amount of base chips that Joker gives me permanently. And so I just started playing straight after straight after straight. And I was at like hundreds of straights. And every time I played even like a shitty straight, I was getting like 80,000 points. Just obscene points out of it. And it felt great. Most of the time, that's not what happens. But all this to say, like, there's just a lot of crazy ways you tweak it. And what's so beautiful about it is you have this amazing roguelite element that works really well because you're thinking about how you want to move forward. Mm-hmm. There's a beautiful risk reward in between there because the amount of jokers is limited to five. So sometimes you want to run a joker that's just going to help you get better jokers, right? Like a joker that gives you money. And at some point you have to decide, okay, I need to sell this joker in order to buy this other joker. Mm. Or this joker is no longer serving me. I'm going to sell it and buy like a different pack of something because it's not going to be useful for me in this coming runs, right? Mm. There's also sort of quote unquote boss fights. Like every three hands, there's some really devastating rule, like you don't score any points with clubs, or the blind is like five times as high, like major challenges like that. Or the worst one is you can play exactly one hand and you have to win and earn all the points with just that one sort of god hand, so you're just throwing discards left and right to try to achieve it. But what I really love is when you're in a game, the risk reward of your discards and trying to figure out how many points am I going to get without the game actually telling you and calculating how many points you're going to get, so you're not sort of min-maxing it every time. Because you have to decide, like, okay, I'm not trying to make the best hand to win this one ante. I'm trying to basically make the best average hand. And so there are times where I say, I'm going to throw out my two pocket aces because I desperately need to hit a straight, right?
Right.
And if you don't draw into that straight, now you have nothing. Like, that hand you play is worth garbage.
Right.
Right. You might have run out of discards. You might be digging and digging and digging. And so you're constantly in this risk reward of like, okay, I think I can get enough points there by playing it safe. Or do I push it and take the bigger risk in order to get the better hand this round and hope that I'm not screwing myself for future hands in this run? So it's a really cool like risk reward system. And despite all of what I'm describing feeling complicated and extra layered, and really, like, I'm not even sure there's any more fruits to be harvested from the poker game. Like, I don't know what else you could possibly do to poker to change it any more than Bellagio does. It still feels, when you're in the play space of it, just extremely elegant because you're buying a few things here and there, you're tweaking things just a little bit each run, but it starts to expand in your mind the sort of possibility space every time you get a new Joker or you get a new Celestial Pack or you get a new, weird cards that destroy cards in your hands to augment your deck so it's only face cards. And then, there's all these different combinations that you're thinking of in your brain, but it doesn't overload you because it's dulled out in just the right amount as you progress through the game. So all that is to say, I think Bellagio was fucking awesome. And like, this is this year's Vampire Survivors. Like, this is the game that I will be, if I've got 10 minutes and I got my Steam Deck or pretty much every time I'm waiting for you to hop on to like do the podcast, I'm playing Bellagio. It's very good.
I mean, I think, it's just, it's funny to me that it's not that they abandoned the rules of poker. It's more just like, it's a framework that they use to like draw you in with something that a lot of people are familiar with and then just kind of like mess with the expectations. Like that, mm-hmm. that's just stuff is like very funny to me where it's such a well-known set of rules. It's yeah. inherently amusing to then undermine it. And not in a mean yeah. way, but yeah. undermine it in like, yeah, that shitty pair is actually better than a royal flush because of your multipliers and stuff. Yeah, so it's
yeah,
like, yeah, it's funny. Silly question. Is there any gambling component to this?
No, there's no gambling component.
That's even more hilarious because it's like, that's yeah. like a core mechanic.
Yeah, you can't, other than the, again, the risk reward of how you use your discards, right? Like right. using the resources is the quote unquote gamble, you know?
Right.
Do you buy a pack, right? Like you might not get the thing that you want when you're right. buying a pack using the money. Are you better off holding it? Like, so for example, to even add more complexity, you can earn interest in this game. So every time you finish a round, for every, I think it's for every $3 or $5 you have, you get an additional dollar, right? And so there's this risk reward, and it is a kind of a way of gambling of like, do you yeah. spend all four of your dollars to open this pack, or do right. you hold on to it hoping that you'll get a better pack next round once you earn interest? But if you don't open that pack, you might not get like a joker that's going to save your ass in this next yeah. round, right? Like
yeah.
that level of having to sort of figure it out, it feels very, very good. I mean, there's a video, a Game Maker's Toolkit, who runs this great YouTube channel that dissects design.
Yeah.
I talked a bit about Bellagio, comparing it to The Binding of Isaac. And I think there's something really great about that comparison, because The Binding of Isaac has the same idea of this unknown items that you're discovering in your run, and
right.
maybe picking it up is going to change it for the better. Maybe it's not. Do you risk right. it and leave it behind? Like, how do you want yeah. to approach tackling the unknown, right? And yeah. and dealing with the unknown
right.
when you're trying to sort of build this perfect run, right? Because you're not equipping yourself in the way that you would in like an action RPG where you're going to, okay, I'm going to buy this materia and these weapons and swords to right. make myself awesome. You're like, right. okay, well, do I spend $5 for a mystery box that might be a better weapon, might be a better experience,
yeah.
or do I hold on to it for later and gamble? Or do I invest and buy, like, so for example, the vouchers that augment your entire run often reappear round after round after round for a set. I think it's for the whole set. So if you can't afford it right away, you could hold it and then buy it later, right? But those are like $10, and oftentimes, you know, you're running really lean. So there are right. times when I'll just say, okay, I'm not going to buy any cards because I think that voucher is going to be really good in the future. Maybe it gives right. me an extra hand, or maybe it says like celestial packs appear twice as long. One of the best ones that I found, and happened for this straight one as well, was every time you open a celestial pack, and celestial packs are the ones that change how much the base value of a hand is worth. Every time I open a celestial pack, it is guaranteed to have a card to increase my most played hand, which in this case was straights. And so I got my straight up to like +8. It was just absurd because every time I opened a celestial pack, I could upgrade that same hand. So by the end of the game, I was only playing one hand. All I cared about was straights. Just straight. but again, like that risk reward is just so satisfying. It's such like a tenuous play space there, you know?
Right. Man. It seems, yeah, like I said, this is certainly on my list, but it's like one of those things where it's like, oh, if I don't finish Final Fantasy VII before I start playing this, will I ever?
Yeah.
So like I've been like cautiously circling around it, but yeah, I will certainly dive into it.
The one thing I'll say is that the games are, you can play hands in like, you know, less than a minute. It's very, very easy, but that's exactly the same thing that results in you saying, okay, well, one more hand.
Exactly. And I mean, yeah, that exact thing happened to me with Vampire Survivors and basically any roguelite that has come out. So it's I can see the time. I can see the event horizon of my time going into this. Like,
yeah, for sure. Yeah. All right.
Let's completely change games here, and I'll talk to you about The Theater.
Ooh.
You know, Princess Peach is always a classy person. She's decided to give live theater a chance this time around, which is funny because it's canonical that the Super Mario franchise Miyamoto thinks of it as like a traveling troupe of actors playing roles in all of the various games.
Yeah, yeah. In real life, even, Bowser and Peach are a married couple. Like, that's why they...
I mean, it's basically... It yeah, it's like the Always Sunny cast. But, like, this one is, like, fully into it. So, like, Princess Peach Showtime is the game that came out. And the whole game is this, like, Princess Peach goes and has to go through different set pieces that are all constructed like a stage, like a literal, like a live theater stage. And, you know, of course, there's like a big bad that in a very like Luigi's Mansion style turn of events kind of like locks everyone in the theater, and Princess Peach has to find all of the sparkles and, you know, free all of the... This is gets really weird. So like there's these like little creatures called Theets, T-H-E-E-T-S.
Like theater things.
Yeah. I mean, and this gives you a sense of where this game is operating, because my 7-year-old found that very amusing. You know, he was like, I get it, Theets. And I was like, yeah, that's, I think that's the joke. Like, if you even call it a joke. And Peach is, and then, you know, Peach is helping the Theets by using her sparkle power. She encounters like this magical star that is like has like a ribbon, so she can like tie it in her hair and then can swing the ribbon around to like re-energize people with sparkle. And fight back the bad power, which is referred to as Darkle.
Hell yeah, dude. Someone thought real hard about that one.
And so like, and then, you know, my youngest is like, she's obsessed with Princess Peach, and she already knew this game was coming because one time we turned on the Switch and, you know, those little like preview panels on the left-hand side when you turn it on.
Yeah.
There was like a promo unit for the Princess Peach game in one of those units. And she was like, what's that? Is that Princess Peach? What is that? And I was like, motherfuckers, like this is what the advertising games. Yeah. It's like, yeah. I mean, you know, I was already planning on, you know, getting the game for them anyway, but it was just like another one of those things where it's like, they knew what they were doing with this shit. Yeah. But anyway, so it is a third person 3D action platformer, largely a like left to right type of thing. It's like the stages have depth, so you can go like down upstage and downstage. And in every stage, it's a slightly different mechanic. Like you have a different Peach plays a different role, you know.
Yeah, see, like Mermaid Peach, Cowboy. It's like different stage productions each level, right?
Precisely, and the mechanics are slightly different. So, in the Ninja Peach, she can do like wall running and you know, triangle jumping up walls, you know, kicking mm-hmm. off the walls and going back and forth. And then in the Cowboy Peach, she has a lasso and can, you know, lasso enemies and ride a horse and all of that stuff. So like the mechanics change slightly from stage to stage, and you have to do different challenges based off of what the theme of the stage is so far.
Mm-hmm. That's cute.
It is. I think that's the operative word. Like it's very simple. I mean, it's literally a 2-button game. Like there's jump and then your ability.
Jump and sparkle.
And when you don't have one of those, one of the stage abilities, it's literally the sparkle ability. Like there's just a sparkle button.
Yeah.
But each stage ability is different enough where like the one where Peach is like a patissier, like making, sweets. It's kind of like a, I don't know how to describe it, but you're basically trying to recreate the picture of what the cake should be decorated like, mm-hmm. and like 3D kind of decorate it so that it matches up, which is like totally different from like the Ninja stage or whatever, where it's basically like a third person brawler.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's kind of this cool thing for like, again, I think this game is meant for like all ages, like pretty aggressively, and like especially kids, where it's kind of exposing the kids to like a bunch of different 3D platformer game mechanics.
Yeah, like multiple games in one. Yeah, multiple games in one, for sure.
Totally.
But I can imagine what sounds a little bit like frustration on your part, which is to say there's no one design that is then thoroughly explored or plumbed for everything it's worth.
Not so far. I mean, we haven't finished it yet, and there's different, like you'll go back, you know, you do one stage as the ninja, and then later on there will be another ninja stage that will introduce a little bit more, you know, mechanics or challenges or whatever. And so, you know, to be fair, we haven't gotten to the, you know, we haven't gotten through the whole game, but it's been this interesting survey of mechanics, and it's pretty high quality, like just in terms of how it works and like how everything fits together. It's just a very, it's a very chill game in terms of what it's asking. You know, it reminds me a lot of like the Yoshi game that came out on Switch, and that, the ethos of the Yoshi games,
the past couple
Yoshi games of just like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. The Woolly World, all that stuff, where it's like, the point is here, actually the experience versus the challenge, where some of other Nintendo games, even like Mario Wonder, the point definitely was the challenge, not just the experience. And this is quite different from that.
I could see a lot of value in playing that with someone that's just on the younger side, right? Like thinking about what, almost like Spirit Tracks. What's the Toad game?
Oh, Captain Toad, Treasure Tracker.
Treasure Tracker, right? Yep. You know, something that is easier to understand, doesn't require a ton of commitment. And if you get bored, well, you just go to a different level and it's a completely different level.
Yes.
You know, there's something satisfying there. But this is also the first game with Peach as the lead. Do you feel like it sort of lived up to, or is living up to, the promise, or maybe like the demand to not do her dirty, you know?
I mean, I think I was reading an article where like the last Peach game was called Super Princess Peach, and I think it was like a DS game or something like that. And and it was one of those things where like one of her powers was like crying.
It's like, oh, okay. God.
Yeah. But this one is very, I mean, this one I'm quite satisfied with it because like, and again, it's weird because like
my daughter, you could be all these things. You could be a ninja. You could be a,
yeah. But it's not like a thing where, like, my daughter really likes Peach because she's a princess. Like, she likes the girly aspect of Peach, but this is like a girly aspect, but not in a condescending way, where it's like all the outfits are adorable, but not in a condescending or objectifying way, which is a good line that they walked, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Nice. Okay, well, cool. Not something I'll probably play until Ozzy is old enough, but, you know.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think that will actually be fun, you know, at that point. And, you know, they can even do it on their own because it's just very forgiving. Like, it's hard to fail out of the games. And even if you do, they like give you like extras to like make it even a little bit more doable. I don't know. one more piece of trivia about this game. It's directed by the guy who did the Goemon game on the N64.
The Goemon. What is that?
Do you remember that? Or am I the only weirdo that really has that game in a really fond place?
No idea what you're talking. Oh, gee. Yeah, okay. I know what this thing is. I found the trailer.
Yes. So there was this, the Legend of the Mystical Ninja game on the N64, like part of the long-standing Goemon franchise. When I learned that, it started to make a lot more sense because that game was kind of the N64 equivalent of, like, there were multiple different gameplay mechanics. Like, some characters, like, you could turn into a mermaid and swim around in that game. And then some stages of that game, you were in a huge robot kaiju doing a first person, like, robot battle. And then other stages were, like, kind of 3D Mario 64 style gameplay. And there was just kind of a tone to that game. One was like
Streets of Rage.
Yes, it's very similar, right? And so it's like, oh, this guy, this is his style, kind of, you know? Like,
this is what he does. He's only done it twice, but this is what I mean, he's probably done more than that. But,
well, I mean, he's now the, you know, he's like one of the leaders of the studio now, but like this game, apparently he's named as the director on, and the last game he was the actual director on was that N64 game. Which is really, because I really liked that N64. There's a certain charm to that game that I really like. And now knowing that there's some shared DNA there, it makes a lot more sense around how this game is structured.
Yeah. I love that someone can make this experience however long ago and then just bring it back. You know what I mean? Like, I know. Revive it. That's something I love about video games, though, genuinely, right? Like, because mechanically speaking, there's nothing that says it can't be brought over, right? Just because you've got better graphics and better tools, you could still take the heart of something that was great from that era and sort of revive it. That's
totally
cool. I dig that.
So I'll let you know if there's a huge twist at the end and, you know, Peach breaks bad and becomes evil or whatever, but I'm not assuming that that will happen.
Wild. Well, we've been going a really long time on these two games, so why don't we touch briefly on Final Fantasy? We can talk about bugs another time. We'll talk about Final Fantasy Rebirth, just because we want to talk a little bit about our recent experiences.
Because we're still dozens of hours away from the credits of that game.
Dozens of hours in, but we did get to see an amazing scene, minor spoiler, very minor spoilers, where Red 13... It's so weird. Red 13 puts on a Shinra outfit and moonwalks to challenge Cloud publicly to a card game for a tournament. It is extremely bizarre. I don't know what's going on there, but I think that that moment to me struck me as emblematic of what I think is going to be a growing problem in this game, which is content bloat. As a result of needing to make a longer game that is taking place in a weird spot within the overall story of Final Fantasy VII and an open world game to meet those expectations. Because the entire cruise ship sequence feels like you could cut that out of the game 100% and not lose a damn thing. Right. And yet it takes like 3 hours.
Right.
Maybe 3 hours is aggressive, but it's a long sequence. I mean, the overall narrative bit that's important is what? Like, there are monsters that can turn the robed people into bigger monsters. That's it. That's the only sort of like narrative connection. But the Queen's Blood tournament that you're sort of required to play. I'm a big fan of Queen's Blood, by the way. I'll happily play Queen's Blood. It feels so unnecessary. To that entire sequence, the idea that like your compatriots are playing, that you play Chadley, who's on the boat somehow, like you meet all these people, it's weird. And right after that, and you know, I won't spoil it for you, but the Costa del Mar sequence is kind of that all over again. Like it is a lot of mini games that really have nothing to do with the story, and then once again they reiterate at the end, monsters can turn these robed men into other monsters. Like that's the whole sequence. And I'm just struck by like how weird it feels to be this deep in and being stuck in this weird like tonal shift in the game. And I know you were saying like some of this was in Remake, so I don't know, maybe you're right, maybe I'm rethinking it, but how did it come off to you?
I think overall I agree with your take on they're tasked with a weird task, which is make an already really long game, i.e. Final Fantasy VII, the original, now make it three games.
Make and it's it like three times as long.
Right. And it's like, okay, so like, and I had to jog my memory, but like there is a boat sequence in Final Fantasy VII where you're basically stowing away on a Shinra ship. It's not like a cruise ship like in this one. Like they do mix it up a little bit, but you're stowing away. And there is like a mini little sequence of Red 13 in a fake, you know, in a Shinra outfit, faking his way through, you know, the stowaway sequence. But like, it's pretty quick.
Yeah.
And he's certainly not doing the moonwalk in it. And so I think it's one. I think Final Fantasy VII has only gotten progressively more anime as the years have gone on.
Yes.
And so like the anime absurdity is just accelerating. And then two, to your point, they're filling up more space. And so they're putting in both these wacky interludes and also these mechanical interludes of like, check this out. Now you're going to, even if you didn't play Queen's Blood, now you're going to play like five games of it in a row. Unless you like bow out of it or something. I mean, it's, I am looking forward to weirdly them getting back to right now. It seems to be pretty, closely adhering to the original game, and I want them to start messing with it again. And I think there's something that they can start doing, but like I'm more interested. The parade sequence where you meet the president. Mm-hmm. I think that was a pretty big departure from the original game. Like, I don't ever remember that section of the game. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, but like, at least that explicitly, where like Cloud almost makes a deal with Rufus.
Yeah, just to call it quits. I was
like, oh, cool. I was kind of excited about that, where I was like, oh, cool. Like, this is like, they're going to start messing with the timeline again. And maybe this will, we'll start to see where fate starts to branch or whatever. But then they kind of didn't do it. And so
Yuffie is the enacting fate, as it will.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, I wanted more of that. And then they kind of shied away from it. And so, and they got to do it at some point, because they opened the whole damn game with Zach. And so like, they still need to loop back somehow to that other timeline.
Yeah.
We just might get a lot more weird shit before that happens.
Yeah, there are elements with Aerith in particular that you get the sense things are a little bit weird, like something else is going on, but it's never as explicit as I would have expected going into this from the last game. I mean, I understand why, like, this must be the trend, right? And they're likely going to do this with the next title also,
right?
Just to say, set it up and establish it within the context of what you expect and then subvert it, right?
Right.
The seeing Sephiroth and some of the ways that you've seen him fighting them, like, I don't know, that, I guess that's a little bit different, but it doesn't... I think it's the tone that is maybe weird to me. Like, it just doesn't feel like it's committing to that change in a way.
Right.
Or the bigger, it's not committing to the larger swings.
Yeah.
The boat stuff in particular, I think, suffers from major pacing problems, because we go from the military scene where you're doing the quick time events onto the boat where you're doing more sort of forced non-combat stuff into Costa del Mar. Where you're doing more of that, right? Yeah. Costa del Sol. There's a mini game called Costa del Amor.
So it's the
one that gets stuck in my head. So I think doing all three of those things back to back feels just especially weird, because you're taking such a long break from the open world exploration outside of Midgar, where like, oh, the whole world and the real drama is waiting. Like, we saw Sephiroth with these weird roadmen, this big snake thing. Like, I almost died. It's wild. Into just... very kind of grinding halt of Junon, but you're not really exploring a lot of Junon because you don't have a chocobo yet,
right?
And then you're just into all of these like forced sequences, you know. I mean, even the going into a bit more detail into even the boat sequence, like there's a scene where there's monsters everywhere, the ship has been like torn to shreds, I'm assuming some civilians have died, there's fire literally like on the floor, and as soon as you beat the last boss, the intercom spokes up and goes, everything's fine, guys. I hope you enjoy the rest of your trip. We're going to have fun. Like, you didn't solve anything. Like, not only is the ship in disarray, but there's no sense of where the monsters came from. Could there be more? Like, you just come on out. It feels like the game is full of shorthand, despite being significantly longer than you would have. Like, if you're at this point where you're adding so much content that you need to abbreviate that content, maybe just don't add so much. You know, like, we don't need all of these layers of personalities. Like, just let us get to the meat of it, because when you do, I think you get some really interesting stuff. After the Costa del Sol sequence, there's some moments on the beach where you talk to each of your compatriots, and there's like touching stuff there, right? Even the way that Barret is very protective for some reason of the robed people, I think is great. Like, he remains I think the coolest character in Final Fantasy VII. The one that I'm most sympathetic towards. And so there are those moments that come out where you're like, okay, cool. This is true to the characters. This is getting at the story. I'm really like liking this exploration. Yep. Even Yuffie, I find to be a lot of fun. I always loved her in Final Fantasy VII and enjoy her here now as well. But it just shifts back and forth dramatically between those two. And it's, I don't know, it's not working for me yet in that regard. You're right. Maybe if I was a bigger weeb still, I'd be into it, you know. But we were talking before the podcast about it, because you had texted back and said it's almost as though they let Hideo Kojima direct the sequence.
Yeah,
because he's known to break the fourth wall,
right?
But Kojima just does it so artfully, where it never feels dissonant with the themes of what he's showcasing anyway, right? Like, if the fourth wall is broken, yes, it's kind of like tongue in cheek, but it's often in service to the theme that thing is about.
Right.
Whereas I don't, I don't get that same degree of self-awareness from the moments like the Red 13 moonwalk, you know?
Mm. If they had set that up more on like, yeah, I think, again, I think this comes back to like, if they had set up more around the push and pull between what is fated to happen versus what they're trying to make happen, then some of the absurdity could be taken in that context of this absurdity is yet another attempt at them trying to thumb their nose at fate. But yeah, since they haven't done that, then it just is weird, you know?
Like, what would happen if Cloud was like, Cloud vocalized how surreal it is that no one is batting an eye? Like, what is going on? How come everyone thinks this is normal when it's clearly not normal, you know?
Or, maybe or something like that would have worked. Red 13 was doing that shit, and then all of a sudden the black spirits, phantoms came and like knocked them back down or something, you know?
Stop doing the moonwalk, Red.
Yeah, it's like, what are you doing? Yeah, it's like, oh, okay, got it. Sorry, fate. You know, like.
Yeah, well, you're like pushing on the boundaries of what you can get away with in that space. Yeah, right. I think that could have been cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I agree with you on the boat stuff, but the boss of the boat, I was like, oh shit, this game is like really expecting me to pay attention now. You know, I was like, that's when I was like most like mechanically engaged with the combat. I was like, oh, I can't just mash my way through this. I actually have to think about this fight now. Yeah. And so it's funny to have that happen at the same time where I was thinking, ooh, the story's kind of like drifting a little bit. And at the same time, I'm like, ooh, the fighting is getting locked in right now. And this weird, like, I don't know. I'm obviously fascinated to play more of it. So like, it'll be cool to see where it goes from here. Yeah. And it's funny because I almost get the sense that they knew, because before you started the whole military sequence, there was even like an in-game pop-up that was like, hey, you won't be able to come back to Junon for a long time. So like, do you want to do this? And like, it almost feels like they kind of knew, like, hey, this is kind of a roughly paced part of this game. Maybe we should just warn people, you know?
Yeah, maybe they should have been more on the nose about it. Like, hey, you're about to have to do a bunch of forced weird shit. Hey, you like Queen's Gambit? No?
Yeah, if you don't like Queen's Gambit, maybe do a few more side quests, because guess what?
yeah. Stretch your legs here, because you're going to be sitting down for a while. Yeah. I mean, whatever. We're still going to play through it, but not what I expected, I guess, of these early hours.
Yeah. All right, well, we will revisit it at some point after we brush up on our dance moves. Experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is the website. You can find all of our previous podcasts, including our original Final Fantasy VII debrief back in the day, experiencepoints.net. Wherever you find podcasts, do us a favor, leave us a review, tell a friend.
Cool. All right, everyone. As always, thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Ciao.
Every time we